Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. I've been trying throughout the morning to figure out whether we have a fairly large group or a fairly small group today. It keeps kind of changing. Now it looks fairly large. But, you know, I realized either way, you can't really lose when you're the speaker, because if it's a large group, you say, it's great to see how full the Zendo is. And if it's a small group, you say, isn't it wonderful to sit with such an intimate group? I think what I've mostly been appreciating is the weather. It's so temperate and soft. And after the long summer, it feels very refreshing. And in this kind of mild climate, our practice, to me anyway, as I look around, takes on a very, I should say, a very non-special character. We've got a group of experienced people here for the most part today, and everyone knows their jobs. And, you know, when there's a high component of beginners in the group, there's a lot of drama, you know, trying to get people to go to the right places and get the bells ringing and all of that. You know, but in a more experienced group, things are a lot more ordinary, boring. Bell rings, you get up, you do walking meditation, bell rings again, you sit down. And of course, this very ordinary natural quality that I'm sensing in the practice today is the result of a lot of work by a lot of people. Our registrar, who put this together, the Tenzos, who have been laboring busily in the office there, plus all the years that many of you have been putting into practice on the cushions. So this kind of ordinary, flavorless practice is the result of heartfelt sincerity and effort through many nens, through many seconds and moments, days, weeks, and years. So I thought I would talk a little today about the quality of practice and the glory of practice, not glory in any big deal sense of the word, but the glory in the sense of how fulfilling and nourishing it is. We're told many, many, many times, you know, Dogen's famous formulation, that practice is enlightenment. And so that immediately raises the question, well, all right, great, what is practice? And as it happens, Dogen wrote not one, but two chapters on this in this Shobo Genzo, Continuous Practice, number one, and Continuous Practice, number two. So he thought this was quite an important issue, obviously. And he starts off with this observation. He says, on the great road of the Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continued and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. So for me, I think what he's saying here is practice is not something special that you take time out of your life to do. From the moment you begin to question your life, from the moment and your death, from the moment you want to go more deeply into what it means to be alive, what it means to be human, in that first moment of aspiration, practice is already completely realized. And then what follows from there is also the realization and the manifestation of practice. So it's not as if, you come in as a beginner and you don't know anything, and then you get more and more enlightened. Oh, you learn the forms and all this. But what Dogen is saying in the practice of the beginner, right from the get-go, the Dharma is just as present as in the practice of a sage, like Dogen Zenji. It doesn't increase in the sage, and it doesn't decrease in the beginner. And he calls this the circle of the way. In other words, moment by moment, all these elements are practice, are present. Aspiration arises, you follow through, you realize the moment, and the moment fades and changes into the next moment. So you can say that this continuous practice goes on like that, or you can look at a larger chunk of time and say it's going on in that larger chunk of time. You can slice the time any way you want, from the merest nanosecond to a lifetime of practice and beyond. And it's always about aspiration, realization, transformation, aspiration again. Ceaseless practice, continuous practice. It's not something that you do to get to some particular state of mind. It's not a transactional type of thing. You put this many hours on the cushion and you get this many units of enlightenment. It's present in each moment without increase or decrease. And we continue, it is our joy to continue on the circle of the way, moment after moment, day after day. If you believe in it, lifetime after lifetime, continuous without end. So that's what Dogen says, and I don't believe it's possible to know what practice is, but practice has a flavor. I think that everyone in this room has tasted this morning. And so Dogen and other people, the lives of other people, can give us a sense of the flavor of practice. For me, it's kind of like oatmeal, it's not like a real wow type of flavor. It's kind of bland, but it warms your heart, and it's kind of nourishing. So Dogen goes further and he says, continuous practice is undivided. It's not forced by you or others. And this unforced, very natural kind of practice, he says, affects the entire earth and sky in the 10 directions, although it is not noticed by others or by yourself. Although it is not noticed, it is so. So I think one thing that it's important to realize is that practice is not limited to we who practice this particular form. The spirit of practice can be present in any human endeavor. So we choose to practice in this particular container. But, you know, among my patients, I have someone who is a writer, practices writing very seriously. And he says, I wish I had time for Zen, but writing is clearly his practice. And, you know, when I think of writers who practice, I think of James Joyce, who, as far as I know, never said Zazen a day in his life. But he was a writer, and he wrote, and that was his practice. And there was a very particular way in which he went about it. He just wrote. So maybe initially he desired, in fact, one of his novels is about this. He desired to be a great culture hero and redeem Ireland and bring the truth to the world. And that was his young self. And in his book, Ulysses, one of the themes of it is how this young fire-eating self is not the true hero. It's the embryo of the true hero. And the true hero, Ulysses, is a man with a job and a wife and a son who unfortunately died very early in life, who walks around an early 20th century Dublin, going about his business, selling advertising, and goes home to his wife at the end of a long day. That is the practice hero of Ulysses. In his next book, after receiving amazing praise and kudos among the literary set, he went in quite a different direction. He began to write Finnegan's Wake, and he just started writing. And as he released bits of it, the people who had loved Ulysses, many of them said, what the fuck are you doing? this makes no sense. Why are you wasting your time with this? And he just kept writing it. And it was a very ordinary kind of writing. He had endured such starvation in his early life that his teeth rotted, and the rot of his teeth affected his eyes. So as he had lost most of his eyesight by the time he started writing Finnegan's Wake. And so he had to write really, really big and, have a secretary help him. And he did this year after year after year. Few people believed in him and supported him. Many more thought this was the most incredible literary folly they had ever seen. And whether it was folly or genius, He just kept writing it on and on. And he did so for 17 years. And he finished it the same year that World War II started. And I wish I could say that now the world knows that James Joyce did not waste those 17 years. No, opinion is still pretty divided. Some people think it's one of the greatest books ever written, and some people think it's just mental masturbation on the page. Myself, I find it unreadable as a book, you know, starting at page one and reading through to the end, but reading it here and there, a few pages at a time, I find very rewarding. And it starts out with a line that to me conveys the flavor of practice. River run past even atom, from swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by commodious vicus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs. And that sentence starts with river run. That's the continuation of the last sentence of the book. So the whole book is circular, just like the recirculation of the river itself, which starts at its source and flows to the sea and then evaporates and rains and starts at the source again. That whole circular quality, which to me has the flavor of practice. I wanted to mention Joyce because it's just as an example that it's not all about monks and heroic Zen practitioners, that ceaseless ongoing practice is available to anyone if they follow the truth of their hearts. And as Dogen says, if they lay aside the ego ideal of what's in it for me, lay aside fame and gain, and just do what comes naturally, whatever that is, whatever getting up at the sound of the bell is for you in your life, that's practice. Trying to be the most amazing person who ever rose up from a cushion, I wouldn't say you're outside the way of practice, but you're separating yourself from it. You're separating yourself from that, the circle of the river, from the circle of the Dharma. You're creating suffering for yourself and suffering for others when you could be flowing, when you could be putting one foot in front of the other and noticing how the bottom of each foot meets the floor as you shift your weight. In Dogen's essay on ceaseless practice, the form of the essay is mostly telling stories about great Dharma heroes. And he starts off with the original Dharma hero, at least in terms of Zen, goes Bodhidharma. And again, he brings out to me the flavor and the quality of ongoing practice. through this story. And as he relates the story of Bodhidharma, he fleshes out, I think many of us are familiar with the koan about Bodhidharma, which is sort of an abbreviated version. But I think this fleshed out version is very pertinent because it's full of flavor, full of that flavorless flavor. And so Bodhidharma, like the Buddha, you know, he started out in life as a very big deal. You know, he too was a prince. And he became a great practitioner in India. And somehow it got back to India that the emperor of China was very pro-Buddhism, really into it. You know, Buddhism was in China considerably before Zen practice came to China. And so Bodhidharma, who was one of the foremost practitioners in India, decided to go to China. Nothing in it for him, really. You know, he could have stayed in India and been a big deal, but he got on a boat, risked his life, endured the comforts of a three-year sea voyage, and managed to arrive in China. And, you know, the emperor heard of his approach and was delighted and greeted him. You know, he sent out a party to greet him and bring him back to the palace with a lot of pomp and ceremony. The emperor could hardly wait because he'd been practicing Buddhism for a long time. And, you know, here was the real deal from India and who could validate his practice. So as soon as Bodhidharma got to the palace, he was ushered into the presence of the emperor. And the emperor said, "Ever since I became emperor, I have built temples, copied sutras, and approved the ordination of more monks than I can count. What is the merit of having done this?" And Bodhidharma famously said, "There is no merit." And then the emperor said, he obviously was a sincere man. He didn't say off with his head. He said, "There's no merit. Why is that so?" And Bodhidharma said, "These are minor achievements of humans and Deva, which become the causes of desire. They are like shadows of forms and not real." So to me, what he's saying is, if you're doing it to feel like you amount to something, that you're a good guy, a moral person, a benevolent ruler, or for any other reason besides just to do it, these are just causes of desire. They're things that you're clinging to. And if obstacles come up, you'll try to push the obstacles away, and you'll be caught in the whole cycle of karma. So the emperor said, "All right." Imagine how deflated he was. He says, "What is real merit?" And Bodhidharma said, "When pure wisdom is complete, the essence is empty and serene. Such merit cannot be attained through worldly actions." What is pure wisdom? Well, when you put your right foot forward, shift your weight on it, and then bring the left foot up and put it in front of the right foot, repeat rinse, and that will take you around this room very nicely. And then the emperor said, "What is the foremost sacred truth?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." And the emperor says, "Who is it that faces me?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know." "What is this I don't know, Bodhidharma?" For me, it means, well, this is my practice at this moment. I don't know. I don't know what practice is. And my practice will continue into the next moment. And I know won't know what that is either. Practice that can be known or not known is not the practice that Dogen Zenji is talking about. That's practice as an idea we keep in our skulls, and then we match ourselves up to the idea, and we either pat ourselves on the back when it matches, or we beat ourselves up when it doesn't match. That's separation from practice. That's separation from the circle of the Dharma. Not real separation, it's the separation that's our delusion when we get these kind of gaining ideas. So Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." And in the next moment, this "I don't know" turned into Bodhidharma's plan B. And so he saw that much as the emperor loved Buddhism and had everyone practicing it, not much was going to go on. And he had to try to teach the Dharma in another way. So he left. He left and he ended up at Shaolin Monastery in a cave, where he sat and faced the wall for 9 years. I think he was quite willing to be a big deal back in Emperor Wu's kingdom, but his intention was to teach the Dharma, and he saw the time was not yet ripe. And so he became the physical manifestation of the Dharma and sat facing the wall for 9 years. And just as I noted with Finnegan's Wake, I wish I could say that Bodhidharma's practice was vindicated, because after those 9 years, a true seeker came along, Huayke, and he was able to transmit the Dharma to him. But that was not the purpose of sitting and facing the wall for 9 years. Sitting and facing the wall for 9 years was complete manifestation, just as getting on a boat to China was complete manifestation, just as engaging in Mondo with the well-intentioned but clueless emperor was complete manifestation. Bodhidharma didn't say, "Oh, well, if I sit and face the wall for 9 years, someone will come along and I can have him be my successor." That's how it unfolded. And luckily for us, that Dharma is still unfolding right here on this day in our practice, in our ordinary practice of aspiration, manifestation, realization, and then letting go of all of it, and aspiring again. Just getting up when the bell rings and sitting down when it's time to sit down, ending the Dharma talk when it's time to end the Dharma talk. So I'd just like to leave you with what Dogen says about the requirements of ongoing practice. You don't have to be a genius like Shakyamuni Buddha or Bodhidharma or Dogen Zenji. He says, in continuous practice of the way of Buddha ancestors, do not be concerned about whether you are a great or a modest person, whether you are brilliant or dull. Just forsake name and gain, and don't be bound by the myriad conditions. Do not waste the passing time. So, if you're a big deal, the Dharma is completely manifested. And if you're just, you know, an ordinary person doing his best to practice the Buddha way, the Dharma is not for 1 minute manifested less than it is in the great genius or Dharma heroes that we read about. As Master Joshu said, ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary people are the way. And in this ordinary, extraordinary way of ceaseless, ongoing practice, the world is nourished, and the seasons follow each other, and great peace comes upon the land.